Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
You're watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. A prosperous middle class is seen to provide the foundation not just for a robust consumption-driven economy, but also a healthy democracy. But the COVID-19 pandemic has caused many to slip down the economic ladder, eroding living standards and savings. How much state support is being directed to addressing a middle class in distress? And is recovery just a matter of time? What impact will a shrinking middle class now have on Malaysia in the years to come? To help us think through some of these pertinent questions, joining us on the show tonight, we have prominent economist and former United Nations Assistant Secretary General for Economic Development, Jomo Kwame Sundram. He's the recipient of the Vasily Leontov Prize for Advancing the Frontiers of Economic Thought. Jomo, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
If I may begin our conversation with this popular assertion that the Malaysian middle class is in crisis, that you know that this is a crisis that is one of such magnitude that perhaps the middle class might not recover even when the public health issues are under control. I'm wondering, Jomo, whether you agree with that and what evidence is there for this crisis?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that the people in greatest distress are not the middle class. They are the people in the informal sector mainly, both employees as well as petty businessmen. But a lot of these petty businesses are involved people who see themselves as middle class. So the term middle class is very nebulous, especially as it is used in this country. And then the introduction of these categories of B40, M40, T20 and all that have confused the discussion quite a bit. Some of my colleagues have basically argued that that we have a B70 who basically do not who live almost without making any significant savings. And the only people who can afford to save a little bit are basically the middle class, so to speak, basically the top 30. Now, of course, this embraces a whole range of people. And different people are in very, very different situations. And this crisis, the very nature of the crisis and the trajectory of the crisis have affected different people very differently. For example, if you're self-employed and you are affected by the physical distancing requirements, you're not able to carry on your business affairs and so on and so forth. As usual, you'll be terribly adversely affected. On the other hand, if you are a beneficiary of the wage support scheme, which the government has provided for many employees, of especially of large enterprises, then you're in a much better situation. But clearly, there is distress. This distress is palpable. You can see it. There are reports of a great deal of what some people would describe as antisocial behavior, as you know, all kinds of phenomenon which we are not very comfortable about talking about in Malaysia, partly because they have slightly different connotations in different cultural circles, as well as arguably in different class circles. So many of these people are affected. One could even say that some of the rich are adversely affected insofar as they're not able to continue business as usual. So the crisis has hit many people in very, very different ways. For example, those affected by international involved in international tourism have basically seen their livelihoods wiped out. And so, you know, it really has, it depends on where you are and how you're affected, depends on where you are and your sources of incomes, how much savings you have, and what kinds of support mechanisms you may have.
Jomo, you know, during the discussions about BRIM, it was said that in the several iterations of BRIM, we saw a portrait of Malaysia and in terms of people who are economically vulnerable, right? So BRIM, as it became more targeted, still captured, what, over 7 million, 8 million Malaysians who are economically vulnerable. Wasn't the idea that the middle classes are more resilient, They're the ones who can withstand personal crisis, you know, have savings together at a moment's notice, and so on and so forth. It's that middle class that we're talking about. Have those people who were once thought to be resilient stop being so?
Well, we go back to the same question as before. It depends very much on your occupation, depends how much your income streams are affected by the very nature, not only of the pandemic, but also very importantly, by the nature of how the various measures imposed upon businesses, upon everyday life, and so on and so forth, affect our income streams and livelihoods and so on and so forth. So, you know, for those who are, for example, able to continue as we are, for example, virtually, we are not adversely affected. But for those, for example, whose income flows depend on showing up at work, you know, every time there is a lockdown, you can forget about any income. And it is those kinds of people who are most adversely affected. And then there are all kinds of combinations and permutations thereof. You know, people who are affected because of their living conditions, but who are not affected because of their income streams, and or who are variously affected because the nature of their income streams. There are some people who have been able to adjust, develop new measures. Some businesses have closed down, and other people have done delivery services instead. But, you know, you can't, not everybody can do delivery services. So there's a limit to what can be done in these constrained circumstances. So all of us really have a stake in bringing an end to this whole situation. But unfortunately, as we have seen, 15 months into the crisis, at least in this country, we don't seem to have, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel seems to be quite elusive.
I do want to come back to the question of the end of the tunnel, Jomo, but I wanted to ask you, for that middle income bracket household that has seen their household income impacted, either diminishing or you know, halved, the economic vulnerability that they're facing now during the pandemic, wondering what impact that might have, not immediately, not just in the short term, but in the long term, you know. Middle class is a kind of a social class that you think of higher education or tertiary educated. And I'm wondering what that means for intergenerational social mobility, whether COVID-19 and the damage that we've seen done during the lockdown periods means education interrupted, investment in education interrupted, upward mobility interrupted.
Yes, that's a huge package, and we really have to unpack it a little bit. Also on the imagery of tunnel vision. One of the problems with tunnel vision is that, you know, if you're looking for the light at the end of the tunnel, you're not paying very much attention to what's happening on the left or right, or let alone above and below you. So this is a problem because you're kind of focused on the end, but not about how to get to the end and what and the dangers involved along the way. But coming back to your question, we have a situation where if we assume the number of that the people who are in the middle class basically have tertiary education, for a generation before me, only 1% of that age cohort, people over 70, for instance, actually made it to university. For my generation, things opened up a little bit. But today, about 30% of the population sees itself as having been in or going through tertiary education. But that's for the youngest cohort before the pandemic. And of course, all that has changed now very radically by the recent disruptions. So I think, and increasingly for the younger generation of university graduates and so on and so forth, they are dismayed by the income prospects. They are dismayed when politicians tell them that they should be willing to work below the minimum wage, you know, as long as they can get a job and so on and so forth. So we have a situation where, in a sense, the world in which we once lived in has been so fundamentally shaken up. And part of the challenge for us right now is this fundamental destruction of a world and many of the assumptions which we made Many people, for instance, have taken loans with the expectation of being able to service those loans, to pay for their vehicles, to pay for dwelling places, and so on and so forth. Those things are no longer assured. Now, a number of measures introduced by the government have helped some people, but not everybody. And so that's part of the reason why the middle class feels extremely threatened. And we just saw this report, for example, today, by the new CEO of the EPF, who expresses that, you know, who says that some of the measures which were EPF was forced to take were so challenging for the institution, you know. And when you think about the EPF, it's one of the dullest, you know, most stable institutions one can think of, you know, a regular nothing terribly exciting, but you know, you can always count on a regular income and so on and so forth for them. All those assumptions about our existence, our life in Malaysia, have been so fundamentally challenged by recent developments. And this is part of the problem.
Right, Jomo, does or has Malaysia's position in the International Division of Labour in terms of the kinds of foreign direct investments that we can hope to get in the years to come, has that changed? Has the economy of the world changed so much that what was generated here because of our location within the global system, has that changed?
I certainly think so. You know, one has to remember that even before COVID-19, there was already a great deal of talk about how automation, how digitization was going to fundamentally change our lives. How many people, for instance, were going to lose their jobs to machines, to algorithms, and so on and so forth. There were a great number of fears and concerns about that. Some of those processes will be accelerated. Some of them will actually be retarded. Some of the old supply chains in which we were fairly deeply embedded have been so fundamentally disrupted, nobody takes anything for granted anymore. That's why people, for instance, have a renewed discussion about food security. What does that mean? Do we forget about some of our old concerns, for example, about food safety, about nutrition, both of which are very, very serious problems in Malaysia? We are on the cusp of becoming a high-income country, but you have nutrition problems which suggest otherwise. So you have a great number of issues which need to be addressed, and now they are being subverted by more primordial kinds of concerns and sentiments. And this, I think, is a very, very major challenge for us. But at the same time, that it is the easiest way to think about it is to think about the familiar, about the past with which we are familiar, and about the restoration of the old as far as possible. But you can imagine that air travel, for example, is going to take quite a long time to recover. And the very fact that we are having so much, Minister Khairi mentioned this question of vaccine apartheid, which the EU ambassador vehemently denied. The fact of the matter is there is vaccine apartheid occurring at the global level, whether you like it or not. And we now have one of the largest companies, Pfizer, for example, having changed their medium-term business strategy. They are working on the premise that COVID-19 is endemic and will be with us for some time to come. Their future business strategy does not rely on revenue streams from Lipitor, which was their number one earner, or even Viagra, which was their number two earner. It is now COVID-19. And we're not just talking about vaccines. We're talking about a whole range of things, particularly tests and hopefully in the future, some treatments as well. But these are going to be held by some transnational corporations, a big pharma, which are going to basically disadvantage everybody who is not capable of paying the prices set by Big Pharma. And we do not even have the kinds of protections which you have in some countries in the West, for instance. And this is I don't want to frighten people, but, you know, we really have to rethink our assumptions about the world we live in and whether we can continue to accept many of these things. If you take, for example, the whole question of revenues, you know, tax revenues were going down, 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 down over the decades. But now, suddenly, you know, we realize that we have hardly anything in the kitty. And you need to spend big to get out of this crisis. Because it's not a matter of, you know, let us say the lockdown is over, you turn on the switch and everything goes back to normal. You can't just do that. People just do not have incomes. If they do not have incomes, they are not able to spend. If they don't have they spend, people cannot produce for them to buy, and so on and so forth. So you need to keep things ticking, even when you are disrupting economic activity. And that's why it's so fundamental to ensure liquidity for the population as a whole, but particularly to help those who are most distressed in the present situation.
Gemma, we want to come back and pick up on those things that you've just mentioned, but let's take a quick break first. We'll come back and continue this conversation in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned to Consider This.
Maka lebih sukar untuk COVID menjangkit kita.
Untuk tempoh 2 minggu ini, duduk di rumah. Kalau kita boleh laksanakan KKP, kendiri dan keluarga,
saya kira insyaAllah kita boleh berjaya. Akhirnya kita menang.
Perang COVID-19 masih belum berakhir. Dalam kita berusaha memutuskan rantaian wabak ini, kita jangan terpedaya dengan virus maklumat palsu. Semak fakta melalui www.esraawani.com atau aplikasi Esra Awani. Teruskan berdisiplin, ratakan lengkungan pandemik ini.
The third wave of COVID-19 has taken us by storm. There's no room to take anything lightly. Everyone must follow all the steps to stop the spread of COVID-19, social distancing, face mask, follow these steps, this SOP, with the utmost discipline. Together, we can flatten the curve.
Kini berwajah baru.
Ini pula susulan nahas pesawat Back Air di Kazakhstan. Pesawat berkenaan dilaporkan tergelincir dua kali.
Notifikasi berita terkini dan navigasi mudah. Podcast dikemas kini dengan berita dan program.
Rebirth. Reformasi, resistance and hope.
Serta video tanpa had dengan scroll tanpa henti. Buat turun aplikasi baru Astro Awani sekarang.
Semua yang terjadi adalah berita, tetapi tiada siapa yang boleh bawakan yang terkini dan tergempar seperti kami.
Dilihat hanya memberi wang tanpa matlamat yang tepat.
Dia tidak melakukan apa-apa kesalahan.
Untuk mendapatkan jawapan yang bermakna, kita perlu soalan yang tepat.
Amat sedih dengan apa yang berlaku di atas.
Tiada ruang untuk berita palsu.
Negara kita telah merekodkan kes harian baru sebanyak.
Hanya fakta yang diberikan.
Amat penting untuk meneruskan perjuangan negara melawan pandemik ini.
Sentiasa
Hello, thanks for staying with Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutan, and we're speaking tonight to economist and former senior United Nations official Jomo Kwame Sundram. Jomo, picking up on some of the things you mentioned before the break about the need to spend big to get out of this crisis. But Malaysia seems to be facing a triple crisis at the moment, not just public health and economic, but also one that is political. I'm wondering whether you think the political crisis and the instability risk is inhibiting our ability for better policymaking, maybe bolder fiscal action, as you mentioned, spending big, and even more coordination amongst ministries and agencies and the like. What do you think?
Well, we have a big problem in the world. We have a situation where it is the rich countries which are spending big. They are running major deficits. Many of them do not even borrow from abroad. They borrow internally. Japan is the classic example, but even this is also happening in Europe and elsewhere. And they do not need to borrow from abroad because they don't need it for foreign exchange purposes. They're not importing anything. They're basically trying to generate activity. Now, in the old days, maybe I was perhaps the last Mohican there, we went to university, we learned Keynes, and the government was supposed to be the employer of last resort. Well, those days are over. Today, what you need is a buyer of last resort, a purchaser of last resort. This is what is needed for the government to go, to keep the economy going. Now, unfortunately, developing countries in general, including Malaysia, are not spending more. And part of the reason is quite understandable. Politically, many people are very suspicious of many of these countries. They're suspicious of the governments, whether the governments will spend the money correctly, whether the governments will spend the money to help those in greatest distress, or basically reward their cronies. This is a problem which we find in many developing countries. But there are also other problems. There's a problem of where do you borrow? Many governments think that the only way they can spend more is by borrowing from abroad. They need to realize that they can actually borrow domestically. And in the past, this was not an issue. But the kind of economic thinking which now prevails, which is now so dominant, now serves as a fetter. It serves as shackles on the minds of economic policymakers. So economic policymakers are hesitant to borrow much more. But even when economic policymakers are willing to do that, there is lack of political support when they do not enjoy legitimacy. And this is the fear. When a government is seen as biased to a particular region or to a particular community or to any particular constituency at the expense of other constituencies, it does not enjoy the legitimacy. And therefore, people will always see whatever they do, even when they do the right thing, with some suspicion. And that's why it's so important to have legitimacy. And part of that legitimacy is achieved when you have a whole of government approach. And this has been achieved in many East Asian countries. It's even been achieved by Kerala state and even Tamil Nadu in South India. It has not been achieved, unfortunately, in many other countries. And many people see the whole question as essentially a public health issue. And perhaps you need the police to help you around to ensure order. That's the approach, unfortunately, by all too many governments. But the governments which have been able to involve all of government so that you start beginning to rethink the organization of public space, rethink the organization of public transportation and so on and so forth. All that has been achieved, for example, in South Korea, a Korea which is vehemently democratic in its sensibilities, at least for the younger population. But, you know, the government enjoys the legitimacy of from the people precisely because it involves not only all of government, but also the whole of society. We do not have a situation where the whole of society feels involved in dealing with this challenge.
Jono, the last time we had you on our show was about 6 months ago, at the very start of the emergency. And I wonder if we could look at that, this last 6 months, and what lessons you draw from it, you know, apart from the lockdowns and the roadblocks and that kind of blunt tools that have been used during this period.
Well, you said you answered yourself, because the basic problem with lockdowns is that they are a very blunt instrument. I want to re-emphasize Japan, Korea, Taiwan province, China, Vietnam, Laos, Kerala. None of them had nationwide lockdowns. Okay, China had lockdowns because the situation had spun out of control in the first couple of months. And they had lockdowns in Wuhan City and the three provinces around Wuhan City, because there were a lot of commuters who worked in Wuhan, which has long been an industrial hub of China. But other than that, they did not have a nationwide lockdown. They took a lot of precautionary measures. They did a lot of testing. And so on and so forth, but no lockdown. And this was very important. And it's part of the reason why China did actually continue to grow last year. And Vietnam continued to grow last year. But you had a sense of involvement, of engagement by the entire population. But that can only come about when you have a government which seems to have a comprehensive approach involving all of government. Look at the reforms, for example, on adjusting schools. You know, we've had television education through much of the second half of the 20th century and into the early 21st century. But when we had the lockdown, resort to digital, you know, perhaps because that's what the people at Davos said is the way to do things these days. You know, but we have to adjust to the realities of our situation. And if we had done television almost immediately, we would have found ourselves in a very different situation. There would still be problems, undoubtedly, but the problems could have been considerably lessened. Lots of kids could have actually had access to classes.
Right. Jomo, before we end, we have a few minutes left now. I wanted to ask you, because you have been, thinking about this for a while, and you've been thinking about the tentative lessons that we can learn from COVID-19. Can you tell me, in the time that we have left, very quickly, which is the one lesson that you want Malaysia to heed the most?
I have great difficulty talking about the 10 of squeezing my usual presentations into 10, and now you're asking me to give you the one lesson.
We only have a little bit of time left.
I think the engaging all of government and all of whole of society is fundamental to any effort. If we are going to lick this crisis, it is going to be through our combined efforts. It's not going to be because some official up on high, basically settled. It is important, of course, for those people to make the right decisions to enable, for example, vaccines to be available and so on and so forth. You look at the enthusiasm for vaccination, and contrast that with the lack of enthusiasm for so many other things. You know, I think there are lessons to be learned even from the very uneven experience of the last half a year. But I think we have to go back to the last 15 months, because the problem actually begins 15 months ago. And it's all very easy to say, it's all because of the backdoor government and all that. But there are, even if you did not have a backdoor government, what could we have learned? We should have been looking east, as I've tried to suggest. Nobody pays attention to that. Instead of looking west, we only change our approach after the British government dropped its original approach, and because of the ICL, the Imperial College of London study, which suggested to them that up to 2% of the population might die. That really shocked the Boris Johnson government into action. And the rest of the Anglophone world followed dutifully. But we have to be much, much more independent. I mean, I was listening very proudly to the Kerala State Minister of Health, who's now greatly celebrated all over the world. She was talking about how she received help from Malaysia to deal with the Nipah epidemic in Kerala in 2018. You know, I mean, it was, and here was Malaysia being cited as a good example. But, we can't live on our laurels, right? We have to deal with the problems they are, and we cannot, and there is no playbook by which you can deal with this crisis. You have to learn very, very quickly. And you can't learn very quickly when you have, a bunch of people who are put together simply because on the basis of, rather dubious criteria, let me put it that way.
And on that note, Jomo, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight. That was
my pleasure.
Prominent economist Jomo Kwame-Sundrum wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Farhad Kutin, signing off the evening.
We will be back with you same time on Monday. Thank you so much for watching the show. Have a great weekend, folks. Good night.